Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 49 in Albuquerque, I'm Tara Gatewood. There's a federal law still officially on the books that prohibits the government from distributing any federal aid to tribes that harbor non-Indian captives. That's among the dubious laws from a bygone era that were never revoked. One U.S. senator from South Dakota is working to find and repeal some of these old laws. Have you ever come across some of these outdated rules for society? Did you feel they were racist relics of the past? Tell us about it right after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native leaders from the U.S. and Canada gathered this week in opposition of the Keystone XL pipeline. More from Dan Karpinchuk.
The ceremony opened with a prayer as tribal leaders from the Great Sioux Nation and the Ponca Nation in the U.S. and the Blackfoot Confederacy in Canada put their signatures to the 16-page declaration. It's an agreement to coordinate efforts to fight the Keystone XL pipeline. President Donald Trump has given his thumbs up for the project, saying it will bring thousands of jobs and help boost the economy. But Native leaders in Canada and the U.S. have been fighting pipeline development for years. Councilwoman Casey Camp Horanek is with Oklahoma's Ponca Nation. She says the pipelines are killing her people, calling it environmental genocide.
We have Keystone XL coming through our territory. We know that children who are near that are 56% more likely to develop leukemia than children 10 miles away.
The Native leaders at the ceremony represent tens of thousands of Indigenous people in both countries. They say their declaration is also about treaty rights, but what they really want to do is draw attention to their fight against the $8 billion pipeline. Calgary was chosen for the declaration signing because it is where the head office of TransCanada, the pipeline developer, is located. The company says the pipeline will be environmentally friendly and create jobs. Keystone still has a number of hurdles to overcome before it can be built. Environmental groups have launched a court challenge, and regulators in Nebraska have yet to approve the pipeline route through their state. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
In a departure from the previous administration, the Interior Department announced Wednesday the National Bison Range in Montana will remain in federal control. Nikki Ouellette of Montana Public Radio reports.
Last year, the Obama administration proposed to hand over management of the range to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The BIA would then transfer local control to the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes. Tribal spokesperson Robert McDonald says that would have been the tribe's preferred course of action.
While the tribes continue to believe that restoration is an elegant solution to the question of national bison range management and would continue federal ownership of the land, we do look forward to further discussions with Secretary Zinke and the service regarding our common interests in natural resources stewardship.
Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke says he is committed to not selling or transferring public lands. The Fish and Wildlife Service is accepting public comment on a comprehensive conservation plan and environmental impact statement to be considered for future management goals now through June 19th. For National Native News, I'm Nikki Ouellette.
Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke is accepting public comments on a review of 22 national monuments. Those are open for 60 days, but for Bears Ears in Utah, which a number of tribes hold sacred, the comment period is 15 days. From KJZZ's Fronteras Desk, Laurel Morales reports.
The accelerated comment period is challenging for people who live in remote areas of Indian country. Arizona State Representative Eric Descini visited with dozens of Navajo elders when he helped start the Bears Ears initiative 8 years ago, and he calls the review time irresponsible.
They don't, one, have access to the internet, and if they do, they're not as astute to jump on social media. I mean, this is grandma and grandpa we're talking about, who probably, you know, don't know about this very small window. One could argue that it services, you know, a certain community and disregards an entire population.
Secretary Zinke visited Bears Ears last week and questioned whether a monument status was the best way to protect the land. The public has until May 26th to comment on Bears Ears. For National Native News, I'm Laurel Morales in Flagstaff.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by Ramona Farms, offering wholesome and delicious foods from our heirloom crops as our contribution to a better diet for the benefit of all people. We are honored to share our centuries-old farming and culinary traditions online at ramonafarms.com.
And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood. Right now, there is a law in the United States that says if any tribal organization acts hostile towards the United States, the president can declare all treaties null and void. That law is among several laws in the United States that U.S. State Senator Mike Rounds is proposing be repealed. The Respect Act, which stands for Repealing Existing Substandard Provisions Encouraging Conciliation with Tribes, recently passed in the Senate, and it was passed the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs with a unanimous vote. And we asked Senator Rounds why now is the time to repeal the laws.
They were statutes that were really kind of a very sad reminder of the hostile aggression and the really overt racism that was displayed by the early federal government toward Native Americans, as the government really tried to assimilate them into what was considered modern society at that time. And there's simply no place in our legal code for those laws today.
And today we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about these old laws, other laws on the book that people feel should change. And we're also opening up the conversation to controversial name places and statues that are changing or should change. And is there a racist relic of the past in your area that needs to change? Give us a call. 1-800-996-2848 is a number. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And now joining us from Stanford, California, is Greg Oblovsky. He's an assistant professor at law at Stanford Law School. It is our pleasure to welcome Greg to the hour. Greg, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
And Greg, we just heard a little bit from Senator Rounds about it's time to reverse some of these old laws. And is there anything you'd like to add to that of why now is the time to do that?
Well, I mean, I think these laws have been archaic for a long time. They've largely been unenforced for most of the last century. And, you know, I applaud Senator Rounds for combing the code and finding some of these relics of the past and seeking to repeal them. I think, you know, it's merely a first step. I think there are things with much more immediate consequence that that the Senate can and should be doing. But I do think this is an important gesture, at least in that direction.
Indeed. And let's go ahead and get into, there's a list of different laws that are in question. Are there any that stood out to you?
Well, I think what's interesting when you look at these provisions is they sort of symbolize the world as it existed when these laws were passed in the late 19th century. I mean, one that stands out to me is the law specifying the withholding of money for captives other than Indians. That reflects the fact that the United States was coming into a West that it really didn't understand, a West where there was constant raiding by Native nations, both against other Native nations, but also against Mexicans and Anglo-American settlers. And the United States came in and tried to put a stop to this this practice of captive taking, largely unsuccessfully. This was a hugely important part of the Native economy and a long-standing customary practice. And so it took sort of a campaign of you know 40 and 50 years by the federal government to really sort of intervene in that practice. I think what's striking about it is you see the coercive way that the federal government is trying to to stamp out these customary native practices throughout these laws, right? That it's really an effort to, by the federal government to use the tools that it has to, as Senator Rounds was saying, sort of alter and transform native culture.
Now, Greg, are there any times where somebody has actually called on some of these laws, or do people just kind of see them and say, oh, yeah, that's an old one, or have that kind of reaction? Greg?
So I tried to do a little bit of research on this and look at, as far as I can tell, very few of these laws were ever meaningfully applied. I mean, this was often the case with these sorts of laws. So it's important to understand that the federal government didn't have that much power over native peoples for, especially when it was still in the process of trying to conquer the West, right? It only had a few tools that it could use until it actually subjugated native peoples. And one of the tools that it routinely turned to was trying to withhold the annuities. In other words, the monies that the federal government had promised native peoples in return for the land, that is the exact tool that the federal government was trying to use to force these indigenous communities to do its will. By and large, these laws actually don't seem to have really been heavily implemented. In my research, I find that oftentimes the federal government sort of talks about doing these things, but often native peoples are able to sort of force the federal government to engage in these practices even when it would prefer not to.
And Greg, what got you interested in all of this?
Oh, that's a good question. So for me, I feel like, I'm a non-native person, but I don't think you can understand the history of the United States or the history of the development of the federal government without understanding the role of native peoples in that process. A lot of my work focuses actually on an even earlier period in the late 18th century around the drafting of the Constitution. And my research has convinced me that you cannot think about the formation of the United States and the creation of the federal government without thinking of the huge role that Native peoples had in that process, often in the sort of threat that they posed to the early United States, right? That the early federal leaders felt threatened by Native power, and they felt that they had to respond to Native power. And there was a lot of Native authority and control over much of the nation for throughout most of its history. So I really think that this is, you know, a part of our national narrative that is somewhat understudied and deserves more attention.
All right. Thank you for that. With us today from Stanford, California, is Assistant Professor of Law at Stanford Law School, Greg Oblowski. He's here with us the full hour. If you got any questions for him, you can call in. But as you continue to hear about some of these old laws that are on the books, what's your reaction? What do you think, or what are you hearing when you hear about these laws and exactly the words of them? Does that spell something out for you about how natives were viewed in the past? Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. And then how does it compare to today of how natives are viewed? Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. Are there any racist laws still on the book that you think need to get a second look or simply taken away? Give us a call. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Greg, is there anything else on that list that really stood out to you that you'd like to talk further on?
Well, I think one broader thing that just needs to be pointed out is that, you know, it's easy to repeal these sorts of laws and because they don't have sort of a meaningful practical effect. They're largely archaic now anyway. I think what the harder work to be done is actually to deal with these archaic racist policies from the past that actually do live on in lots of ways. So, you know, I think it's great that Senator Rounds is taking up these issues, but, you know, I think we need to work more to think about sort of the further expansion of tribal criminal jurisdiction that we saw with the VAWA special domestic violence criminal jurisdiction. That clearly needs to be expanded. There needs to be a fix for the Supreme Court's decision in Carcheri that prevented lots of tribes from taking land into trust. And those policies, which live on, are themselves rooted in Supreme Court decisions, laws, racist language of a bygone era, and yet they still have a lot of force, and they're doing real harm in Indian country today. So, you know, as much as I think that these fixing these laws or eliminating them from the books is important, and it has symbolic value, I think it merely has to be the first step before moving toward a sort of broader intervention by Congress, by the federal government, to repair some of the harms that these past policies are still doing now in the present.
All right. Thank you for that. What do you think? Give us a call. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And right now, we're going to go to Rapid City, South Dakota, to bring in Donovan Sprague. He is a historian, university instructor, author, and archivist for the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. Donovan is Minikoju Lakota, and it's our pleasure to welcome him back to the hour. Donovan, thank you for being with us.
Oh, I'm pleased to be here. Thank you, Monica.
And actually, you're talking to Tara. Donovan, when you saw the list of laws, what was your thought, or just even hearing that some of these things are still on the book?
Well, I was aware of several of these that were on the books from at least applicable to South Dakota and Senator Rounds. And, you know, all of the ones who talk about, you know, our people as second-class citizens, or, you know, the use of the word civilize them and anything racist, you know, really need to go. You know, these have been overdue, but at the same time, I've had a lot of, you know, family even affected by some of these. For example, like the Indian Reform School law, 25 U.S.C. 302, where the parents or guardians or next of kin was not needed to place, it says here, Indian youth in said school. And so that really had an impact and effect on, you know, with boarding schools and things like that. And I think a lot of this kind of maybe, like was said earlier, they maybe didn't enforce some of it, but it kind of put the general feeling or attitude out there for the agent to consider. And while once the agent on the reservation had this, you know, they could use what they wanted to maybe like coerce people, or, you know, if you're not in compliance with what the agent wanted. For instance, there was even a competency word, you know, that was used. And so if people could be actually judged incompetent if they didn't go along with the agent, and that could even be that could mean being sent off to a school or some other area. In extreme cases, we had a Canton, South Dakota insane asylum, and people could even end up there, you know, not based on anything medical, but just because they weren't aligned with the objectives of the agent.
And Donovan, what does it say to you that these laws still exist? There are people who are constantly working to make laws work better for our community, making sure that, you know, the law works well. What do you think, that nobody has touched these laws? They're still there. There's some people who know about them. Others don't. What do you think about that, Donovan?
Well, I think they're just people who kind of read over them, and when they do see them, and it's been, you know, overdue for a change with a lot of them. However, anything that has to do, say, like with abrogation of treaties, I mean, I'm kind of nervous on some of those. Like, you know, I think there should be a lot of input from our native law teams to just look at that before, you know, something is just totally scratched out. In that case, there's one, abrogation of treaties, whenever the tribal organization of any Indian tribe is in actual hostility to the U.S. president, authorized to declare all treaties with such tribe abrogated by such tribe, if in the opinion the same can be done consistently with good faith, legal, and national obligations. So those, I think, should be closely reviewed, you know, and anything that might affect a treaty. And then the regulations for withholding rations for non-attendance to school, that kind of goes hand in hand with the other one that I mentioned. Only in that one, it continues that the Secretary of Interior may use his discretion to withhold rations, clothing, and other annuities from Indian parents or guardians who refuse or neglect to send and keep their children of proper school age in some school. So we had a direct effect here with the Rapid City Indian School, where people, and even from my own family, were sent out, you know, and while it says it wasn't the law that they had to go, again, from the agent or the reservation, you know, you had this push and this expectation that families go along with this. But in the case of our family, my uncle just ran away, so that ended their brief stay there. And then another one too, it's not in, you know, it's maybe along the lines of there's a intoxicating liquors here, but in Rapid City, you know, there are signs that just came down in 1952 or 53, where, you know, it actually said no Indians allowed in any bars, establishments. So that was prevalent right on Main Street of where I'm at today. And a lot of these people had served in the war and for the U.S. And I remember it was even cited by one of our mayors, former Mayor Art LaCroix, who was, he had Indian blood in him as well, some Lakota. And he remembered going in and being turned down, you know, back then in the early 50s from entering an establishment.
You know, this has definitely left a really big black mark, especially when you say those signs, no Indians. And a lot of times it said no Indians or dogs allowed in establishments. And so, folks, sometimes maybe we don't think of some of these things that exist or until we hear these personal stories of how relics of the past come across racist, offensive. I think the senator earlier used hostile and aggressive. What do you think of that, the fact that some of these laws are still there? Is it time to start going in and cleaning up things? Does that create more trouble when it comes to the law? Give us a call. What do you think? 1-800-996-2848 is the number. We're going to take a call. We're going now to Tova in Albuquerque, New Mexico, tuned in on KUNN. Tova, thank you for your call. What would you like to share?
Good morning. When I think of laws that are relics of the past, I think of some components of the Indian Civil Rights Act, which were passed in 1968, amended in 1986, and then amended more recently. But in our country, every person, every human being who's facing incarceration by a federal or state court is entitled to a lawyer, and if they're indigent, entitled to appointed counsel. But under the Indian Civil Rights Act, in tribal courts, the tribal courts can impose a sentence of up to a year without the person having a lawyer. So that means that a Native American who's charged with misconduct can lose his or her freedom and job and family income without the same rights that all other people have in the rest of the United States. And I think that there should be a right to counsel, and if a person is indigent, a right to appointed counsel, which also means there needs to be funding for that, like public defenders or appointed counsel in tribal courts.
All right. Thank you for that, Tova. Greg, I'm going to go to you. Is there anything you'd like to pick up on?
Yeah, I mean, I think as the caller noted at the end, funding is the biggest concern there. When the Indian Civil Rights Act was enacted, one of the reasons that they left out an indigent right to counsel was precisely the concern about funding. But I agree that, you know, it's certainly something that tribes should aspire to. It's something that I know a lot of tribal communities are working hard to make happen. You know, it's hard for a small tribal community to bear the costs of having sort of three full-time attorneys in the room, right? You need the judge, you need the prosecutor, and then you need the public defender. So, you know, the funding has to be there for that to happen. And, you know, the federal government has not necessarily always been forthcoming with the funds to support tribal justice systems the way that I'm sure many tribal communities would like. So, you know, I think the other thing that you see is that this absence of the provision for indigent counsel ends up being used as a club by the Supreme Court and other, you know, state and federal courts as a reason to deprive tribal courts of jurisdiction over various offenses. So, you know, it's that provision of the Indian Civil Rights Act has certainly been a meaningful one.
All right. Tova, thank you for your call. Again, you can join us 1-800-996-2848. Greg, also wanted to get your take on the one that Donovan brought up about abrogation of treaties and any thoughts on that? We did talk to Senator Rounds. He told us when he met with natives in South Dakota that they had taken some of these laws off the list of what they were going to present to Congress because they were worried maybe trust responsibility might be eroded. Is there anything you'd like to share? And by the way, that full interview is on our website. Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, so the abrogation of treaty concern. I mean, looking at the text of the statute, I feel like it's hard for me to see how it would, on its face, if anything, it would actually, I think, bolster tribal authority and sovereignty by eliminating the statute. I mean, anytime that the federal government can unilaterally abrogate treaties, that's certainly something that tribes are going to be concerned about. Unfortunately, in a Supreme Court case called Lone Wolf from the early 20th century, the Supreme Court found that Congress could abrogate treaties with the Indians, even over and against the objection of Native peoples themselves. So that law is of a piece with that decision, and it's certainly something that, you know, if I were a tribal community, I'd be pretty concerned about the existence of that statute. I don't see that its repeal actually does any meaningful harm for tribes, but I certainly understand the concern that, you know, this is an area of law where there are a lot of unintended consequences. You change one small thing, you don't think it's going to have a meaningful impact, and then some court down the line picks up on it and decides that this is a hugely important change. So, you know, I certainly understand the need for caution and careful consideration before making any actions in this area.
All right. Thank you for that. And folks, maybe you've never looked up the law, but it's something that people talk about all the time. If there's something you've heard about, maybe you want to run it by our panel of guests, you can give us a ring. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And I'm curious, anybody think that we should be pushing harder to remove some of these laws? Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. After the break, we're also going to be talking about other relics of the past that are offensive to Native Americans. If there's a place or maybe even a statue that you think should be taken down, you can talk about that too. Phone lines are open. 1-800-996-2848 is our number, and we look forward to including you in today's conversation. Establishing good study habits and maintaining healthy relationships aren't necessarily at the top of the lessons list in most classrooms. Having such life skills, though, help make the transition to adulthood easier. On the next Native America Calling, we'll talk with folks from a camp for Native youth that are making life skills a priority. We hope you'll join us.
On in the ninga. Support by the Institute of American Indian Arts, where students can now finish in 4 and pay for 3. Students who join the program and finish a bachelor's degree in 8 semesters get the 4th year of tuition returned. With degrees in studio arts, cinematic arts and technology, creative writing, indigenous liberal studies, and museum studies, there's no time to waste. Information at iaia.edu/4for3. That's numeral 4, F-O-R, numeral 3. Support by the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board.
Were you born from 1945 through 1965? People born during these years have the highest rates of hepatitis C, yet most don't know they are infected. Hepatitis C is the leading cause of liver cancer, but you can do something about it. Talk to your doctor about getting tested. It could save your life. Visit www.cdc.gov/nomorehepatitis.
Welcome back to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Isla de Pueblo, and thank you for joining us today. We're glad you've chosen to spend a little bit of your day with us. And if you've got an idea for a show topic, send us an email. Send it to comments@nativeamericacalling.com. And we are talking about offensive laws and relics of the past, from laws still on the books. And we're going to go into place names as well. And some people are saying all of this needs to go. Are you one of them? Give us a call, 1-800-99-NATIVE. And last week, the city of New Orleans removed a statue of Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederate States of America during the Civil War. And the removal created so much backlash that crews did their work at 3 a.m. and wore masks to hide their identity. What do you think about that? And do you know of any old laws or names that you would like changed in your community? Are there painful reminders of the country's racist past that you confront regularly? Call us and share what you want removed and why. The number is 1-800-996-2848. With us today from Rapid City, South Dakota, is Donovan Sprague. He's a historian, university instructor, author, and archivist for the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. He is Minikonju Lakota. It's our pleasure to welcome him back. Also with us from Stanford, California, is Greg Oblowski, and he is an assistant professor of law at Stanford Law School. Greg, thank you for being with us as well. And gentlemen, when we think about this, I also want to get your comments about just our society today and changing some of these laws. Do you think it would do good, or maybe even ease tensions that sometimes exist in our tribal communities as well as border towns? Donovan, start us off.
Yeah, Tara, I think this is a really good thing for the most part. Just, you know, be careful with the treaties part, but we have a lot of names right in our communities and on the reservation, which, you know, real offensive names, some that I don't even want to repeat the names of that need changed. And a couple examples I'd like to give, too, of a couple tribes that I've had some involvement with or worked with. One of them was the, this was right after Indian Removal Act in 1830. So the Sac and Fox of Iowa were removed down to Indian Territory, or which became Oklahoma. And so, you know, the Sac is one tribe and the Fox is another. And so the Fox, right after Indian Removal in around 1833, petitioned the Iowa governor to move back to Iowa and reclaim some of their original homelands there. And so the Fox were the Meskwaki. So the Iowa governor agreed. So this is a really unique case. Today, instead of a reservation, they call that the settlement, Meskwaki settlement, around Tama, Iowa. So, but then this name, you know, is created for their new name, which, you know, they call themselves Meskwaki. So you go to the tribal offices now, and it says Sac and Fox of the Mississippi Band of Iowa Indians. That's their name. And it's like I said, how would you like to say that mouthful when somebody asks you, you know, what tribe you are? Naturally, you're not going to use that, but that's kind of an obsolete thing in a way. And then the other one, absentee Shawnee, where they continue to use that name in Oklahoma, with they absented themselves from the census with the enrollment in that. And so since they absented themselves, the government, you know, gives them the name absentee Shawnee. I think they could change that, but I think with that, maybe it's more like this is a in-your-face thing, like this is to show how archaic, you know, these ideas were and the feelings toward the U.S., so they have kept that. But I did work with the Potawatomi briefly, and I was aware that the Prairie Band in Kansas, you know, that was as far as they would go towards Indian Territory, and so they got out there and were called Prairie Band, and those that continued on to where Shawnee, Oklahoma is, were the citizen band of Potawatomi Indians. And during the time period that I worked with them, too, there was a thing with the CB radios and that, and kind of some jokes about citizens band. And so they actually changed their name to Citizen Potawatomi Nation is what they're called today. So, hey, that's something that tribes can look at, too. And just for your information, most tribes that most people read about or hear about have their own traditional names that are different than what the general public knows them by.
There's a lot. And it's also exciting, too, to see a revival of this, of different communities pushing forward and you know, having those traditional names replace these others. Folks, anything you want to share, 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Donovan, you got a lot of good history in your head, and we're glad that you're here sharing it with us today. We're going to take a call. Let's go ahead and say hello to Carl Ola, who's on the line in Warm Springs, Oregon, tuned in on KWSO. Thank you for your call, and you're on air.
Thank you. Good morning. And thank you for taking my call. I wanted to comment earlier, and I was so glad that you did include that there were signs and establishments that said no Indians and no dogs allowed, because it was very prevalent. And I think that with this new administration and the president, that it's given a lot of non-Indians the feeling that they can really revive their racism and treat people, you know, differently again. And I wanted to share that my aunt did live through this, and I have seen, you know, the racism, and sometimes it's very subtle and sometimes it's very blatant. And I just think that as Native people, that we need to stand together more. If we had the mascots, you know, for Little Sambo or Aunt Jemima, man, those things would be changed and nobody would think, you know, twice about it, because that would be such an insult to African American people. But yet, people fight about changing the mascots of Indians, and I totally disagree with that. Some of our younger people don't understand that that dehumanizes us, and that's the reason why it should be changed. Sometimes they think it's cool that it's like the Cleveland Indians or whatever, you know, it might be named. And I think there's an education that needs to happen, and that we do need to remember the past. We need to move on, and I understand, you know, that part about it. But when we forget how we were treated and how people were allowed, and it was legal to do this. And my aunt, at 19 years old, lost her first job because she was Indian, because a white person complained that she was Indian and she couldn't serve alcohol. And she wasn't drinking it. She was a server, a waitress.
And, you know, just connecting some of these things, I think, gets us to a bigger conversation of just even how we face racism. Today, we're talking about it within the laws. Maybe there's a name place that's offensive, or maybe there's something that you pass by every day that makes you rethink things. You can give us a call. 1-800-99-NATIVE is the number. Let's take one more. We're going to hear from Samuel in Albuquerque, New Mexico, tuned in on KUNM. Samuel, thank you for your call, and go ahead, you're on air.
Oh, hi. Yes, you know, I believe in taking down those monuments like they did in Alabama, I believe you said. And the thing about that, we have the Kit Carson monument, and then we have that Oñate monument. I think those should be taken down, too, because they definitely represent oppression and slavery and for the Native people here in New Mexico. And that's all I want to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Samuel, for your call. Folks, you can also participate online. You can send us a tweet at 1-800-99-NATIVE. And if you find this program in our archives, you can also post directly on our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com. Well, speaking of other places and other things that are relics of the past that people are saying should go, we're going to go now to a current struggle that's going on, a struggle to change the name of a lake in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The lake is named John C. Calhoun, of the 7th Vice President of the United States. And to do that, we're going to go to Minneapolis, Minnesota to say hello to Carly Badheart Bull. She is a member of the Community Advisory Council in Minneapolis. She's also a lawyer, and she is a member of the Flandreau Santee Sioux Nation. Thank you for being with us, Carly. And tell us more about the push to change Lake Calhoun.
Well, thank you for having me, Tara. I should mention really quick, if you hear any strange noises, I'm home with my new baby. So I apologize for that. But at the same time, I know my family's listening in and they'll probably be excited. So it's a win-win either way.
Indeed.
Yes. But can you repeat the question? I'm sorry.
Just tell us briefly what is going on there in Minneapolis and why a push to change the name of Lake Calhoun.
Right. So Lake Calhoun, as it's currently more widely known, has a Dakota name. The name is Bedemakaska. And the lake was named Lake Calhoun in honor of John C. Calhoun, who, as far as we know, never set foot in Minnesota. He was a Secretary of War who, in fact, established the BIA. He drafted the first, he drafted the Indian Removal Act, led to the Trail of Tears. He doesn't really have a connection to Minnesota, but he does have a connection to harming Native people. I was appointed by the Park Board to sit on a community advisory committee, and that committee was tasked with advising the Park Board on future upgrades at the lake, at Lake Calhoun, Bedemakaska, and Lake Harriet, because these lakes are both part of the Minneapolis Chain of Lakes Regional Parks, which are the most populated parks in the state of Minnesota. And part of the reason I was asked to, actually along with a family member, my sister was also appointed by another park board member. Part of the reason we were asked to sit on the committee was because of our connection to the lake. We're descendants of Makpiawichashe, Cloudman, who led an agricultural village at the lake. And we wanted to make sure that the story of Dakota people that are connection to the place was included in these conversations. And we were actually very surprised and excited to learn once we started sharing our story, once we started educating the people about the Dakota history, that folks were excited about the idea of, rather than honoring the legacy of John C. Calhoun at Lake Calhoun by continuing to use that name, that we restore the original, the Dakota name, as Dakota people currently call it, Bedemakaska.
All right. And Carly, if that were to happen, what would that do for community members or just, you know, even reminding people that these lands where these lakes are, Minneapolis, the whole area was a big booming Native center at one time.
Right. One thing that we've noticed, even in just having the conversation, is that people are getting more interested in hearing our story. They're learning about the Dakota history, about the indigenous history of the places where they live. And what we're finding is that for both Native and non-Native communities, that they're excited about that. What we're also finding is, you know, as part of this community advisory committee, we were tasked with looking at how to make the area more accessible to all communities. And when we go out and talk to African-American communities, when we went out and talked to other communities of color, immigrant communities, what we found was that people were really turned off by the name Calhoun, that they really wanted when it came to looking at making the area more equitable to people of color, to all people, changing the name just seemed to be the right answer.
All right. Thank you for that. And folks, maybe this is news to you that there's a push to change Lake Calhoun and give it its Dakota name. And Carly, say that Dakota name again.
The name is Bademakaska. And I will add that one of the things that a lot of people say is that it's hard to say, that the name Bademakaska is hard to say. And it's not. We've had multiple public hearings. We've had the park board members say the name over and over again. My sister actually had her 3-year-old daughter come and share the name. And it's not hard to say. In fact, Minnesota is a Dakota name. It's a Dakota word. We have a lot of Dakota words here in Minnesota, and it's time that we start using them and value our language, which is in danger for our future generations.
All right. There's baby. See, she's even trying to say it. Bademakaska. All right. Thanks for that. Folks, you can also send us a tweet at 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's hear now from Jim in Spooner, Wisconsin, who called in and is listening to WOJB. Jim, thank you for your call. You're on air.
Well, good day and bonjour. I'm calling from Wisconsin. I'm an attorney and an educator at a Native American community college. I teach law, sociology, and American government. And I teach my students that all of law is politically related. What's happened progressively in New Orleans is related to a political process. African Americans become a majority in New Orleans, and they want the real meaning of the Constitution and equality and the symbols of oppression removed. We in Wisconsin are going backwards. Since we've had Scott Walker elected governor and the Republicans have complete control of the legislature, we used to be allowed to have the issue of Native American mascots, which are offensive, determined by school boards and educators. And now what it is, it's subject to a referendum in which a local majority can reject the removal of an offensive Native American mascot name. So I teach my students, and I think your guests can comment, is that what the Constitution means, the ultimate authority of our law, depends on what 9 people, meaning 5 out of 9, say it is on a Monday morning. And the Constitution is determined by politically nominating members to it. So I teach my students that while we must respect the law is related to politics, and politics is related to public activism. And that relates to all of the things that we're talking about here today. And I'd like to hear a guest response. Thank you.
All right, Jim, thank you for your call there in Spooner. Let's go to Stanford Law School for that one. Greg, any thoughts?
Sure. I mean, there's no doubt that the caller is absolutely right. I mean, the law does not exist outside of politics, and we're seeing that, we've seen that evidently, abundantly clear in the last, decade, and certainly the last year. I think what the hope is, right, is that through activism that Native peoples and their allies can sort of forge the broader political change that can make these sorts of laws change, right? That it is possible, and we've seen that, especially over the last decade or so, Native peoples have successfully organized and successfully managed to get laws enacted that do expand their sovereign rights and do expand the scope of tribal jurisdiction and their authority on their own lands. That, I think, is a tremendous testament to the organization and political mobilization of Native peoples and their ability to draw on broader allies. And, I think that's going to have to continue. I think the struggle over Dakota access and the ability of a group of Native activists to bring tremendous attention to that issue shows that there is the possibility for that sort of activism to have an impact. It's not going to be, it's not going to be an easy, straightforward path, I think, as the caller suggests, right? There's lots of challenges there, but I think the caller's right that's often how change happens, right? We should not wait for the Supreme Court to sort of decide that these relics of the past need to be repudiated.
All right. Thank you for that. And Carly, as we get ready to wrap up our conversation today, is there anything you'd like to share to other communities who might have a similar place that they feel needs changing? What are the first steps in making sure that you're including all the right voices, as well as setting this up so that change can happen as opposed to, the opposite? Go ahead, Carly.
I think the biggest thing is education. What we found is that once we actually got out and started educating people about the history around Bademakaska, about the history of John C. Calhoun, folks didn't know, and they were actually horrified, and wanted to do good, and they wanted to make a change, but they didn't know how, and they were scared to make a change. So once we actually started bringing people together and talking about what that might look like, once we actually brought business owners who had businesses that were named Calhoun after the lake and changed their business names because of the legacy of John Calhoun, come and talk about what that looked like and how, yeah, it is hard. You know, it's hard to get used to a new name. But at the end of the day, if we really want to create a equitable future for our young people, which we have a responsibility to do, we have to take those steps.
And I think this is also just, you know, bringing forward a conversation that often makes the phones ring off the hook of respecting and keeping our native languages alive. Imagine if more people were picking up just one word at a time, how that might change things too. Well, Carly, we do appreciate you sharing about this. And folks, also want to let you know that we will go ahead and post some of these laws that we were talking about today. Maybe you're curious and want to see more of the details. You know, maybe it's something that'll spark something in your own household. There's a lot of essays that get written throughout the year. Maybe this is something you want to connect with the young ones in your house to take a look at some of this. If you write any reports, send it to us. We love reading how material information is used that we're sharing with you here on Native America Calling. And folks, I do want to remind you that you can find an archive of today's program on our website, nativeamericacalling.com. And that's going to do it for our conversation today on taking a look at relics of the past. If there's more you want to say, post directly on our website, nativeamericacalling.com. And thanks again to our guests, Greg Oblofsky, Donovan Sprague, as well as Carly Badheart Bull. We appreciate all the knowledge and look forward to hearing from all of you again in the future as you continue your work. And right now, we're going to transition to a moment and pay tribute to a life that touched many people around the world. Earlier this morning, we heard of the passing of A. Paul Ortega from the Mescalero Apache tribe. He has been known for his music throughout the world, shared the stage with greats like Joanne Shenandoah, as well as Floyd Red Crow Westerman. And hearing of his passing, we know there are many who will be mourning, but we wanted to pay tribute by playing some of the music that he did leave us with. We did have a chance to connect with the family, and we were told that the family appreciates and any prayers and respect that folks would like to play, as well as talking with one of the family members. They told us that they will be planning his memorial for later this summer. But they were very happy to know that he changed the world and led the way for other Native American musicians. So many people had been touched by his life, and we heard directly from his daughter, Katrina, and she said her dad was always there, always cared for the world, and had advice, and appreciates everything that he brought to her life. So today, we mourn the loss, and we celebrate the life of A. Paul Ortega. We're going to go to one of his songs. Maybe it's your favorite. This is The Sunset.
In the Indian world, we find it. It's hard to explain. He lived by his religion and the way of life. I like to try to explain some of the songs to you. The first song I like to do for you is what is known as a sunset. East Coast. then I'll go on. Ben Ajin Dog, Zayelo, Zayehu, Ben I'll go on, Ben Ajin Dog, Shichin de Zaye.
And again, our thoughts go out to the fans and family of A. Paul Ortega, Apache musician. You left us with many great songs like the one you just heard. That's going to do it for our program today. Thanks to the Native America Calling crew, Art Hughes, Monica Brain, Andy Murphy, and Derek Toledo. Also thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, anchor and producer of National Native News. I'm your host and producer, Tara Gatewood. We look forward to adding your voice to a conversation down the road. Again, if there are great folks in your community that you'd like to tell us more about, send us an email, comments@nativeamericacalling.com. We're back tomorrow.
Medicated CHIP marketplace at Luiga, Yorilachtut Ananak, Irenarit Niklu, now Lun Ritlakat Nun, Agilila, right Ringal Rit, Yuvreu Marhat, Irenilhat, Irenatlu, Yuvreu Tait, Amchil Ritlu, Iga Yuluki, Illauskina Unnomk, Kaya Gauhu, 1-800-318-2596, Kasu Pakluku Healthcare.gov, Unakinu Nankhtuk Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Support by the Utah Office of Tourism, announcing the Four Corners School of Outdoor Education, offering a wide variety of field-based educational hiking and rafting adventures, including scenic tours of the Bears Ears region. Nearby attractions include Canyonlands National Park, Hovenweep National Monument, Natural Bridges National Monument, Monument Valley Tribal Park, Cedar Mesa, and the San Juan River. Reservations and summer camp scholarship information at fourcornerschool.org.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization located in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Music is provided by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.